Always wonderful presentation. Now it's Miss Susan Delisle, and she's going to focus on program science, but with an extra focus on integration.
Good morning. First, I want to make a disclaimer. I am not a researcher, and I'm not a scientist by training, but my career in public health has really been focused on application and program implementation. So I'm going to talk about program science really from that standpoint. And from the program people in the room, see if some of this resonates from your experience. So a lot of things have been thrown at programs, some you've heard here, on monitoring and evaluation and service and replication of effective interventions and knowledge to action, dissemination. But my boss, who's from the UK, had used an expression one day called, what we need to focus on is program execution. Well, for me, what came up was something that looked akin to this. Okay, so in the program science paradigm, the ones firing are the scientists and the findings that says, do more network analysis, do more screening, do more structural interventions, get on the internet for your intervention, particularly for STI and HIV. And here's program going, hang on a minute, can we talk about that? So I want to back up a little bit about some basic definitions. So science means knowledge, and knowledge that is attained not just through study or through implementation of scientific methods, but through practice. So many of you who run programs of any type here really are scientists, because through your practical experience, you have a lot of knowledge about how programs can be implemented. Now, science, though I like the last bullet the best, that the purpose of science, I didn't make this up, is to produce useful models of reality. Hang on to that thought, okay? Hang on to that thought. So program generally is defined as a set of activities that are directed towards a common purpose or goal. And it's really the process, and those of you who run programs know, that it's managing multiple ongoing interdependent kinds of projects every day, all the time. So let's think about that reality that science is to depict reasonable models of, and the process of managing multiple ongoing interdependent projects, and see if this resonates with any of you. Sorry. Program? Building it while flying. Sorry you couldn't hear the audio on that, but I think that maybe a slight picture is worth a thousand words. From my experience in program, there's always building it while flying. You can't just shut it down, put it on the ground, and start building a new airplane. So that the trick is always about incorporating scientific findings and morphing program while flying. Now, unfortunately, in this country, we have a couple of silos that I think are important to mention in the interests of integration. One is between science and programs, which have their own silos, their own administration, their own approach to things, their own methods for enacting, and then To make matters more complicated, in this country we have a siloed approach to STD prevention and to HIV prevention. And you mix that with silos of science of HIV and science of STD with the silos of programs, and that's a lot of silo mixing to try to grapple with. Now, at the level of service, however, the same person is often implementing these programs, and that the programs themselves have seen a greater need for integration because the people accessing services are often the same individual. We have overlapping syndemics, we have similar risks, we have different prevalences of these infections. But the reality is that someone who is only getting siloed services is really not receiving the best care or the best information or the best targeting of services that they need. And really, people and communities deserve better than that. And so part of this focus is not just on the integration of the program aspects, but on the science to better serve people and programs. So at the National Center at CDC, the National Center for HIV, STD, TB, and Hepatitis Prevention, there's been a major initiative on Program Collaboration and Service Integration, PCSI, whose operating definition really is about at that interface at the client level, but where the system and the consumer takes place. So in essence, it's about no wrong door for whomever is accessing services. And even if the service cannot be provided right there, that there's a mechanism for them to receive those services somewhere else. Now, the link between this service and science is really that it's extraordinarily important for the scientists to understand the systems in which each of these programs work in order to be thinking about the best kind of science from a program standpoint that will interface. So if you start at the client health impact and you think about service delivery improvement and system design, I think this is really where program science could influence all along the way, but where program science could have the most profound impact. Now, programs have a lot of choices before them, and particularly in STI and HIV prevention. And you've heard some of these in Sevgi Aral's presentation. So before there's ever even any selecting of tools, like which intervention, which thing would be used, there's some things to consider. The prevalence, incidence, and distribution of the infection, the distribution of risk and preventive behaviors in a community, and the mix and coverage of current interventions among those populations. And then a host of other things, but I really wanted to point out the second from the last, which is the estimates of achievable coverage as compared to estimates of coverage, the actual estimates that are required for desirable impact. Big difference, and you already heard that alluded to in Jamie Blanchard's presentation. So you have an efficacious intervention, but if it cannot be brought to scale and the coverage isn't sufficient, is it the intervention that's not working, or is it the miscalculation of what it would take for coverage to actually have impact? So the program realities are that there's a lot of competing priorities, there's multiple epidemics, particularly for STI. The prevalence of HIV versus the prevalence of chlamydia are dramatically different, or the prevalence of syphilis, or incidence of syphilis. And so these are multiple epidemics in different phases. Often interventions that are put out in scientific journals, they're not funded by the programs. They're like, here they are, this is good, go forth and do that. And with what kind of resources? And among program goals, they're not prioritized. So we got a bunch of them, and you're just supposed to go do all of those without really, I think, a sense of how much of this and how much of that and at what point to change. And you've already heard that there's shrinking public health resources, and obviously that is part of program reality. Now, one thing I wanted to point out is an implementation quandary. So there have been several interventions, randomized controlled trials in this country. One was Project Respect, which had STD as a measure, but it was really an HIV intervention. Well, I did my own little survey of these sites here in this country and found out that all of the PI sites, let me reverse that, none of the PI sites who participated in this research implemented this efficacious intervention. And here's some reasons that they said. The funding went away for the research, so they didn't implement the program. Sound familiar? That the research staff was specifically hired to do this intervention, and that really the PIs themselves didn't think that the training in the QI that was necessary to train the day-to-day staff, that the juice wasn't worth the squeeze to basically alter their entire operations. So, and then the other was that what they did locally was to take smattering of pieces of the different interventions and put them together in an intervention that made sense for them. The problem with that, of course, is that that particular intervention, which came from multiple interventions, has gone unevaluated and was not really a part of the randomized control trial. So I say all of this to say that I think it's incredibly important for science to understand the program realities, the program choices, and what happens on the ground. Now, in STI and HIV, there's been a logic model developed for why program looks the way it looks. And you will not be tested on this, but the point I wanted to say is that it's complex, that in the logic model, activities are linked to intermediate outputs and the long-term outcomes, which are the pink clear over on your right, are the big-ticket items, reducing sequelae, reducing incidents, reducing certain kinds of behaviors. But often what the science does is to really focus only on one aspect of the model, particularly in STD programs, which focuses on screening, identifying infected individuals, and getting folks treated, without a consideration in the science of looking how these things are linked and what kind of pressures would happen on a system or need to happen on a system to make that intervention actually effective. So the question really from program is not, do we need more tools? We have actually quite a few tools. There's community intervention, social marketing, about core group and repeaters. Our toolbox is actually pretty full and cluttered. The question really is, which tools, with whom, when, and how long? And I want to focus on the how long, because one of the things that has not been examined very well scientifically is how long do you do a certain thing, and then when what I call the old dimmer switch. When does something get dimmed while something else gets upregulated? What we have a tendency to do in programs is just pile more on and then leave it to program to decide which one of all those pressures will cause a certain intervention to fade away. So the challenge really is about prioritization by the epidemic phase, by the strength of evidence for that intervention, and feasibility. If you're really, really talking about program science interface, about establishing common standards and measures for fidelity to the interventions, and for increasing investment into this program science collaboration, and excuse me, scientists, but not just in the interests or the turf of a particular scientist. It's about what would be in the best interest of leveraging program overall. So Sevki put forth a couple of ideas, and I call these Susan's ideas, around program science focus. It would be prioritizing the many choices that are already available to program. Ought program to do a few focused things really, really, really well for some defined period of time, or continue to do many things with less effectiveness or coverage than doing them focused and very well? Program size needs to focus on the optimal mix of interventions for priority populations, again, the intervention mix, and do a better job, really, of determining what would be the optimal resources. What goes into the staff, the training, the time, what do you have to have to do this? And really around the scope with necessary for the intervention. Now, there are a couple of promising ideas. One of them is around modeling, where you could take a focused look at subpopulations and divide them by your high-risk categories, and then take a look at the interventions. So you could do this thing in a model, like if you did, must be timed, targeted testing, testing with partner services, targeted with risk reduction, or broad-based, and you could actually come up with a mechanism to determine what would be the best way to proceed, or at least a better informed decision about the best way to proceed. There's also the tiers of evidence framework, and this was actually done in HIV around behavioral interventions, and I'm not promoting it around behavioral interventions, but I am, I think, intrigued with the approach around taking evidence-based and putting them in tiers of evidence. So that program would have what's the best evidence for interventions, what are promising evidence, and then what are ones that are theory-based for which we really don't have the practical on-the-ground evidence, and just that might help programs with making better choices. So the program science also, I think, needs to do a better job around coordinating across disease silos. The last thing that I think that programs need is another descriptive epidemiological paper that continues to describe what we already know, have known, and know again. I think that's a wasted resource. We need to go across and beyond case reports in surveillance to address these issues, and certainly in STD we have to go beyond not just STD clinics, but clinical itself. STD clinics in this country are extraordinarily important. However, by best estimates, they see no more than 2 million individuals in the entire United States. So one place might be to start with an STD clinic in a local community and calculate what its population coverage is. I'm not advocating to dismantle STD clinics. I'm just saying we have to go way beyond that. So probably the most important is that there be an identification of packages of interventions by epidemic phase and parameters by which programs could gauge when to change. So what I would advocate, as all of these things are now thrown at program, and we now have a new term, which is program science, let's flip this where program is firing to the scientists and saying, what's the cost, what's the optimal mix, what's the staff capacity needed, and which tools when? Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Wonderful presentation. I have just been intervened on. This is program science, you know. We said we would take questions at the end. But I had an intervention from Dr. Kent, which said, I think it's time to take a few questions or comments now. So, here we are. We will take a few minutes. If you have questions or comments, we will do those. Charlotte thinks that will enrich the discussion. Yes. I'm sorry?
I think including the video clip.
Yes.
I have a question for Dr. Blanchard.
Can you be louder?
Hi, everybody. I thought it was really interesting how you had grouped clusters by the Gini coefficient, which my understanding is a measure of inequality in society. Mm-hmm. So are you starting to look at social determinants of health and inequality and how that manifests itself in STI?
The short answer is that I think it makes both social sense, but I think it also makes epidemiological sense to start measuring what we're doing in terms of disparities. more, because I think it gives us more focus for what we're doing. So I think that's both at, you know, within a priority population like sex workers or other priority populations, I think there you clearly can't have an unfocused kind of a program. You need to focus on those who are most vulnerable, most at risk. But I think at a geographic level, there's also a real logic from transmission dynamics perspective to targeting, because by trying to reduce disparities across geographies, it means that your program is actually being more focused and focusing on those areas that it needs to do better. And I actually think that we should start measuring our programs by the extent to which we're reducing disparities, as opposed to just measuring the absolute change. So in the Manitoba example, for example, we've talked now about we should not just be tracking what the chlamydia rates are doing or gonorrhea rates are doing. We should be tracking something like the Gini coefficient or something like that that's measuring whether we're reducing disparities, because that tells us a little bit about targeting and whether we're being strategic in our targeting and being effective in those hardest to reach populations.
Thank you. Any other questions? Comments? Just one more comment in reaction to that question. I think at the CDC, we are beginning to, in a big way, take into consideration disparities and inequalities and Gini coefficients and all kinds of other coefficients as well. So our next speaker is going to be Ms. Jo Valentine, and she's going to talk about